of Jose Martin Junco on June the 7th to steal drugs and money and weapons. And he had with him some younger folks that he was breaking into the gang. It was a test to see who was man enough to be in the Texas prison gang that they were. He was a member of, and was bringing some new inductees into the process. And it was a test to see how strong the youngsters were in the occasion of a robbery that could easily result in a death, and it did. The other co-defendants in this case were given lengthy citizen sentences, but Yovantes Valle was given the death sentence, and he is scheduled to be executed tonight. Have we with Dennis yet? We don't have Dennis yet. Okay, we're going to go get Dennis yet for tonight's thing. We have been now doing the Execution Watch for almost a year. The whole concept of the program came from a conversation between Elizabeth and I that we thought that the Texas media was being very negligent about, was getting almost blasé about Texas being the execution capital of the world. And so we decided that we would start doing this program. It is not available on a broadcast station unless you have HD radio equipment. And if you do, you're listening to us on that tonight. Or you can get it on the internet through executionwatch.org. Or you can go to theprisonshow.org, and it is linked to executionwatch.org. And our technical genius, who is tonight in Washington, D.C., Otis McClay, is puts this, maintains their website and keeps an archive of these programs on our website. There's another execution scheduled tonight, and I think we have Professor Longmire. Are you there?
Hello, how are you?
I am well. What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, all of the witnesses have gone into the building. The witnesses for the condemned for tonight's victim, if you will, just went in about a minute ago. And so it appears that the execution is going forward as planned. There are four of us on the corner who are out here, and then about seven or eight family members of Yosavna are also here. They are staying a bit away. I talked with them just before coming on air, and they do not want to talk publicly. One of the people is his mother. She is here on the corner, obviously very distraught and prayerful that the execution will not go forward, although it does not look as if those prayers are going to be answered.
Professor, she did not go in. She is out there with you now.
Correct. She is out with us. I understand that his brother is one of the witnesses, and then some other family friends are also witnessing with him.
Okay. And so there's four of you currently in the weather on the corner.
Correct.
And the rest of them are inside, but it was a pretty good gathering of witnesses going in.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last.
Pretty good gathering of witnesses going in.
Yeah, it looked like there were four or five witnesses that went in for him, and then, of course, the regular media witnesses as well. So, and I'm not sure if the listeners realize it, but we are never sure whether or not there are witnesses for the victims, because if there are, they are always in the building before I get here at 5 o'clock. They assemble earlier than 5 o'clock in the main prison. All of the other witnesses, that being the group for the condemned and also the group for the media, meet together in a building that is about 20, 30 yards across the street from the main prison, and so they then proceed in separately. So if there are family members for the victim, we do not know.
In addition to the witnesses from the media that went in to observe the actual execution, there is frequently media vehicles around on the outside, and that is not true tonight?
No, that's correct. There are often media media vehicles. I'm not sure about frequently. That's one of those qualitative judgments you have to make. In fact, my sense is most of the time there are no other media vehicles around, and it's rare that there are media vehicles, but there are certainly none tonight.
There hasn't been a great deal. This is actually a local story here. It's a Passaic-Harris County story.
Right. I realize that. And, you know, the particulars around the crime, of course, make it somewhat of a dramatic kind of a crime, but the execution itself probably is not going to generate a lot of attention locally.
Okay, Professor, our regards to the other vigilants there, and get back in touch with Elizabeth if you have something to report.
I will do that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. So the process has begun, and by that we mean that all of the witnesses have gone inside. They're gathering there, and now Elizabeth's going to fetch Dave Atwood on the phone. He is at a Houston vigil, and we'll find out where that is tonight. Dave is vigilant at keeping vigil on executions. He is one of the is the founder and one of the active board members in the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And Dennis Longmire, who we just heard from, is a professor of criminal justice at the Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, the home of Texas executions. And so we're covering those two vigils so that we will know what happens tonight. But every time someone in Texas is executed, we come into the studio and we produce one of these shows about that execution, and we wind up having some discussions about the general policy of Texas executions and the reason Texas has a tendency to do more of that than anyone else. I'm looking forward to talking to our guest.
Nine people here?
Dave?
Yeah.
You're on the air. What's going on where you are and where are you?
Okay, Ray, we're at the corner of Holcomb and Alameda.
Uh-huh.
And where there's a lot of traffic, and we've got about nine people here today, which not too bad. Nothing spectacular. We're holding our signs. We get usually, if we get a response, it's interesting. It's normally a positive response here. Every now and then you get something negative. Most of it's positive. And, well, we're making one more effort at getting, you know, the message out with our signs and everything.
So people will know that that's actually a convent there.
Excuse me, Ray, sorry.
It's actually a convent there.
Yeah, right, the Dominican Sisters.
Dominican Sisters Convent there. It's a facility that I have utilized for meetings for the prison show and others. And on the other intersection or diagonally across the street is the DeBakey Veterans Hospital.
Right, right.
So you get a good bit of traffic through there for the hospital and then, of course, regular commuters. But the sisters have been faithful at doing this sometimes. I've gathered with them at the cathedral site downtown, not the new cathedral, but the old one,
right,
on the steps. And
right.
They go through.
They've been involved for years and years in this movement. They've been very, very faithful and strong supporters of what we're doing. So we have always been appreciative of their support. It really helps us.
Well, Dave, you've been involved for decades now. This is
Just about two decades.
Yeah. And Dave has a book out, and the title is
Detour to Death Row.
Detour to Death Row by
right.
Dave Atwood. And you can check that out on the internet. But what's the website of the organization? That's another way to get
TCADP.org.
Now, Dave, I'm the unfortunate responsibility of informing you that the process has begun in Huntsville.
Yeah, it sounded like this fellow didn't have much of a chance in the...
Yeah, the witnesses have crossed the street, and I'm going to spend a few minutes here talking about him. When we get some other information from Huntsville, we'll get back in touch with you.
Okay, fine. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you for your faithfulness.
Bye-bye.
And Dave Atwood, a friend of the Prison Show and a friend of Execution Watch, has been faithful to the cause for some time. This particular case is a gang-related case. And it's very easy to just kind of shake your shoulders and say, well, what could he have expected given his background in prison gangs and being in the recruiting business? And apparently he was going to rob a drug dealer. Normally, when you kill drug dealers, you don't get executed in Texas. That's unusual. What I think made this case egregious to the jury was that he was actually recruiting and training younger assailants to join him. Or at least that was the accusation. At various times, he has said various things about the crime. At one time there was a confession, then there was a withdrawal of the confession, and the latest statement in an interview by a Houston Chronicle reporter this week was that his people, namely gang members, gave him up to save themselves, and that he was being wrongfully convicted in that regard. But he was a Cuban national. He came here, lived in extreme poverty in Cuba, in an antisocial atmosphere, and he came here some years ago with his family, and he got into trouble and went to prison, and there he was introduced to gangs and gang mentality. Now, if you're a regular listener to the Prison Show, you know that we don't have a lot of positive things to say about gangs and gang mentality on our show. As a matter of fact, we're very active in the business of recruiting gang members to reform through an available program for them called GRAD. And I don't know what the acronym stands for, but it is an acronym for getting out of gangs, gang rejection, and integration into general population. And that's a very successful program. A lot of folks are going through that. We even have a regular guest on the Prison Show, Pete, among others, that are former gangsters. And now they're just jovial guys who are working very hard on their sobriety and being adapted to a free world lifestyle. I'm looking forward to a discussion with our special guest tonight, and Elizabeth's going to go hunt him up. Randolph Roth is a doctor of philosophy, and he's a professor of history and criminology at Ohio State, from which we talk to him tonight. He's the author of American Homicide, which is a rather lengthy volume that deals with crimes of violence, fatal crimes of violence in the United States. And his book is currently out. It was published relatively recently, and it's a pretty heavy volume, so I'm not going to be reading extensively from it, because we're going to have Dr. Roth on the show here. The announcement of his book was August 24th, 2009, so this is basically hot off the presses. And Professor Roth and I spoke briefly this afternoon in preparation for the program, and I expect that that he's got some interesting things to say about the correlationship between executions, which there are a lot of around here, and violence in our society, of which there is a lot of around here. And he takes an historic, analytical perspective on that. And we're lucky to have him. Meanwhile, we're talking about this Mr. Valle, Yosvanis Valle is being executed. The process is he's strapped to a gurney in the walls in Huntsville, in the Huntsville unit. The witnesses' curtains are opened as they witness the poison being induced via his veins And that doesn't take very long, and then he's dead. Then the witnesses disperse and come out and go back to the rest of the world. When someone from the family is there, there's usually a rush to get to the funeral home because that's the only time in apparently over 10 years that they've had an opportunity to feel the warmth of his now dead body. I know that sounds morbid, but the family members frequently cherish that opportunity because of this long estrangement where they put the condemned killer in a cage, and his mother and his wife and his children, his siblings and his friends do not get to touch him. And touch is a very important part of human communication. And so we've watched this go on for some time. Killing people, executing people is a ritual. A little later tonight, I don't know whether you'll be able to hear it here, but you will ultimately be able to get it off of the archive of executionwatch.org. They're executing the sniper, the DC sniper, in Virginia State, and I will be a part of that show. Professor, are you there?
Yes, Ray, I am.
Well, we have Professor Randolph Roth, who is a professor of history and criminology at Ohio State. And his new book, it's recently out?
Yes, just last month.
Okay, American Homicide. What prompted you to study the topic?
Well, I really started studying it because I wanted to see why we're so violent, and I started it by trying to figure out why some Americans were not violent. So I started the project really studying about Northern New Englanders in Vermont and New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
and studying why they were not so homicidal. And I had these theories about why that might be because of, you know, their very democratic revolution, and they abolished slavery early, and they have a very funny kind of culture. Well, I don't mean funny, peculiar. It's a culture in which you can often get even with a person by making jokes. In other words, instead of, you know, who's the toughest here and going to combat, it's who's the sharpest here, who can poke fun at the other person better than the other person.
Uh-huh.
And they can be very funny about doing this. And so I thought, well, it must be this. But then as I started to study it, my whole theory collapsed completely in the face of the evidence. It just turned out that by the mid-19th century, they were killing each other at a higher rate than people in Liverpool and Manchester, England. And I thought, if the least violent place in the country can be that violent in the mid-19th century, what's going on? You know? So that led me to try to study everything about, you know, every different place to try to figure out what it was that caused even Vermont, New Hampshire to be violent during the Revolution, during the Civil War period. And that's how I got onto this, but my purposes were very specific. You know, I think it is possible for, you know, Americans to be nonviolent, and I did discover that in, say, the northern United States and the mountain south, we may have been the least violent place, homicidal place in the Western world in the 1830s and 1820s. So we had a very nonviolent past in part of our country, and even the slave south was not terribly homicidal in the mid-18th century. So there have been times in our history well, we haven't had the problems we do today. So I was curious, you know, why does it go up and down? Why here and not there? So that's how I got started on it.
Well, are these times, the times that we're living in right now, particularly violent as compared to other periods of American history?
Well, one of the difficulties is trying to factor in things over time. We're looking now, my colleagues and I, at figuring out how many people who were murdered in the past would survive today with modern medicine and emergency care.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought is that's a very big number. But then again, before the invention of modern firearms, it was much harder to, you know, and modern knives, machine-manufactured knives, the weaponry wasn't quite as lethal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we try to sort this out. In terms of homicide rates, we've been stuck between 6 per 100,000 where we are today a year and 9 per 100,000 for really about the last century. So we've been stuck. It used to be much worse during the Civil War and Reconstruction. And in places like Texas during Reconstruction, our homicide rate was at least 10 times what it is today. Texas was very, very violent during the Civil War and afterwards, which we could talk about. And it was very violent during the slave period and before the Civil War and during the Mexican period. So we have been more homicidal at times than we are today, but in some times we've been less homicidal. To put it in perspective, though, Ray, if you figure that our homicide rate is 6 per 100,000 a year, and you're exposed to that rate for your whole life, so your chance of being killed is 76 times 6 per 100,000 a year, which means that at the current homicide rate, about one in every 200 children born in America is murdered.
Hmm.
And it was if we had sustained the homicide rate we had between 1965 and 1992, when it was about 50% higher than it is today, it would have taken the lives of about one in every 160 children, if you sustained that rate over the course of their lives. So it's for an affluent society, we are way out of line with the rest of the affluent world.
Well, by that, what are we talking about in, say, European countries?
Pardon?
What are we talking about comparing that to European countries?
Oh, our homicide rate, like I said, is between 6 and 9 per 100,000. I'd say, including Australia and Canada, have about a third of the homicides we do per capita.
Uh-huh.
And the other European nations have somewhere between maybe a fifth and a tenth of what we have. So we're about we're somewhere between 5 to 10 times more homicidal.
Has anybody ventured a theory that there's a certain amount of homogeneity in European cultures that is not true of American?
It's complicated. Sorry to say that. For instance, if you want to go back in the 20th century, there have been times, you know, we've been stuck at a fairly high, but in world terms, you know, we're about in the upper two-thirds about two-thirds of the world's population lives in nations that are less homicidal than ours. But at times, the Europeans in the 20th century have been much more violent than we were. Like if you take the period after World War I into the early 1920s in Germany and Italy, their murder rates skyrocketed. If you take a look at the end of World War I or end of World War II, I mean, their homicide rates skyrocketed. And so we have to be careful in saying, you know, in allowing our European friends. My European friends are always saying, why are you so violent? And I say, why have you forgotten so quickly how violent you have been?
Sure.
More recently than us.
Well, I mean, we're not talking about other factors. What about the value of life in wartime?
Well, what you can find, Ray, is that the correlates of low homicide, I think we're getting a real handle on them. And it has to do with a lot of the same things that we look at when we look at Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan. It's oddly about nation building. You know, when you have a strong, stable government, when you have security, when people have confidence that legal institutions will give them at least some chance of having their property and their lives protected. You know, when people believe in their government, and this is one of the things that's so extraordinary, our murder rate has correlated perfectly over the last 50 years with the percentage of Americans in each year who say they trust the government to do the right thing most of the time, who believe most public officials are honest. So when we believe in the government, we feel empowered, even if we're poor, even if we're having trouble, because we feel somehow in the long run things will work out. And we know you do need, right, what you need is a kind of a sense of solidarity and fellow feeling, but you don't need to be ethnically or racially homogeneous. Like I said, the northern United States in the 1820s and 30s was very diverse, lots of immigrants, a multiracial society, and still had a low homicide rate. And African Americans were not any more homicidal, even though they suffered persecution, than whites, because they felt the world's getting to be a better place. Slavery has died. We have a chance. And I think you also need a society in which people feel they have a legitimate chance to earn the respect of their neighbors without resorting to violence, that you have to have a sense that, you know, my place in life is or is going to be fair. And when you have all those things in place, and, you know, they're not in place now in Afghanistan, they're not in place in Iraq, you have homicide. And so when our when our government breaks down, as ours did in the Civil War and the Revolution, as the governments did in Europe during World War One, after World War One, and after World War Two, the homicide rate skyrockets. It can get up to 10 times what it is today in the United States, 20 times. And it's funny, it's not just political killing. It's killing to settle old scores. People just feel, I've got to kill you or you kill me. And very often, you'll find, you know, people who start out fighting over political reasons, say like the Jesse James gang or the Confederate guerrillas in North Texas, when they start to lose the war, they turn on everybody. They feel they've been betrayed by their fellow Confederates. They feel they've been betrayed by, you know, the Union, and they just start killing randomly and start robbing and murdering. So when you have the state fail, and you sense this sense of nationality, the sense of common purpose, and sense of trust in government, that's when people start to kill each other in large numbers. And
is that similar to the Bosnian experience?
Very much so, absolutely right. And what we can see if we look at, you're exactly right, Ray. We're studying what happened in homicides in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had a homicide rate that was about like ours or a little less until 1989 when Russia, the state, fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
Their homicide rate went up to 30 or 40 per 100,000, which is 5 to 8 times what ours is today. And it's stuck there because they're stuck in this political crisis, which hasn't been resolved. And there's not that kind of respect for government and not that kind of trust. And the state hasn't been able to provide just even the basics of security. So you have lots of violence. You'll see that say Croatia, it after Yugoslavia fell apart, its homicide rate went up until the end of the ethnic cleansing, and then it went down. But in the former places in East Europe and the Soviet Union that experienced peaceful transitions from communism to democracy, like Slovenia. What's interesting is their homicide rates just dropped. They never rose. But where there was a fight over what the new government was going to be like and who was going to be a Croatian or what kind of government we would have as there was in the Soviet Union, you see the homicide rates skyrocket. And so it's a very clear pattern that we're exploring, a number of us now, in sociology, criminology, and history.
Well, what about anger in society? You know, children, whether they are, no matter what their ethnicity or race is, poor children don't know they're poor.
Uh-huh.
And that's a rather homogeneous grouping, even though it's across racial lines and ethnic lines. Kids go like play in the mud, and if you don't have toys, you don't notice that anybody else doesn't have toys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until you reach a certain age that you realize, wait a minute, those folks are better off than I am. Is that when anger sets in?
Well, the thing is that, you know, the fact that people are better off than you isn't what triggers it. I don't think it's inequality itself. It's, do I have a chance to find respect? And so, for instance, if we take a look at societies like, societies that are based on caste, like Sri Lanka,
mm-hmm.
You'd know this in the colonial period, they're pretty much where you ended up in life is where you were born. If you were born poor, you were going to stay poor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're born wealthy, you're going to stay wealthy, and it depends on what caste you're in. But if people believe in that system, if they sense that their caste is going to be respected, that people in the other caste perform their duties, you perform yours, then they accept that the way things are ordered in life are legitimate. And one of the things that happened so tragically in Texas's history, it goes back to the Mexican Revolution. It goes back to the American Revolution. One of the things that made the homicide rate worse in Mexico after their revolution, or worse in American slave South after the revolution, when you take democratic ideas and throw them into a society that's based on caste and class, where, in other words, you're saying we're all equal, we all have a chance, but the society doesn't change. It's still based on slavery. Poor slave owners don't have opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the paisanos and the jeniceros, that is the civilized Indians in Hispanic society in the Mexican borderlands, they suddenly have the right to vote. They have all these rights and nothing changes. And we when you throw those democratic ideas into that kind of society, it's like throwing a match in a can of gas. Suddenly, a hierarchy that we might have tolerated is intolerable. And you'll find that the wealthy in those societies, the wealthy planters in the American slave South or the ricos in the Mexican borderland, suddenly say, why do I have to prove myself in a democracy? How dare you criticize me? How dare you challenge me? And so you'll see that how people feel is what matters, not the reality of it. If people believe in hierarchy and they accept it, then the level of violence is not going to be that high. But if people look at that inequality, even if it's less inequality, say, in a neighboring society, if they find it intolerable based on what their values are, they're going to start to be angry, and they're going to start to feel any kind of insult they face is a real put down. It's pushing them down this ladder that they already feel they're already, you know, on the bottom unfairly. So they'll turn against their friends if they're insulted. They'll turn against strangers. They'll just be more explosive. So I think the thing is, what we're having, the difficulty for us as scholars is, it really depends as much on feeling as it does on reality. Am I making sense here?
Well, yeah, you're making sense here. I don't know. Let me see if I can get you off into a strange territory. We're overwhelmed right now with the execution or style killings at Fort Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, after this program tonight, the D.C. sniper is going to be executed.
Right.
That's another a different environment, but multiple murders. And Thursday of this week, we're burying, or I'm participating in the burial of one of the two remains left of the Dean Corll murder killings in Houston in the 1970s.
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, but it's a scenario where one person enlisted the help of two basically teenagers, and they killed maybe up to 27 people. The crimes weren't being very well investigated. Those individuals, as opposed to societal influences, were executed. During the case of Dean Corll, he was killed by one of his followers when it became obvious that he was about ready to eliminate them.
Mm.
So those individuals are responsible for a large number of bodies.
Right.
Where does that figure into the theories that you have? Is that atmospheric, or is...
Well, you know, what you'll find, as we've talked about it, when you take a look at... Again, we don't know a lot about what just happened at Fort Hood, and that's just a terrible tragedy. And, you know, my thoughts have been mostly...
Well, it's all speculation.
Yeah,
I mean, and everybody's got a pet theory that they're bouncing out.
And so I haven't thought that much about him. But, you know, what we've heard... You know, if indeed this is, he has in his own mind that this is somehow religiously motivated, if he has it in his own mind that he's been persecuted, again, I these are people who are deeply disturbed. I mean, there's no question about that. But what's interesting is how, you know, they're, in most of these cases, in Muhammad's case, in that D.C. sniper case, you know, they feel that they are really at war with society, the whole thing. I mean, we can see that with Muhammad. He just felt everybody, I'm not a part of this society at all. And everybody to me is, you know, part of the enemy. In other words, what happens for these people is, instead of having that strong sense of empathy across ethnic boundaries, across racial boundaries, and say, you know, we're all Americans, we're all one people, even if we don't know each other, it goes down to a very tiny group. It can be a little gang. It can be an individual terrorist. Or it can be a kind of these you know, terrorist or potential terrorist movements, like the little cell that Timothy McVeigh and Terry McNichol are in. And it's interesting how many of them are politicized, how politicized a lot of this anger is. Which leads back to the fact that when you don't have a high level of political violence, political anger in a society, you don't see a lot of this kind of politically motivated murder. And that's what I, or at least politically excused murder. That I think would maybe be the more accurate way. Because certainly I think that the D.C. sniper has, you know, he has terrible personal problems. I mean, we recognize that. It's no excuse. But that's the fact. And I think that's the same we have with the other cases we're talking about.
Well, let's put some of the killing in a different perspective. Incidentally, we're talking to Randolph Roth, a professor of history at the Ohio State University. And his book, American Homicide, is currently available. What about our killing? What about executions as a phenomenon?
Well, I think the thing that we can see historically, and I'm sure your other experts have said this, that it's very hard, you know, for us to know whether the death penalty has the effects that its opponents or opponents have on society, that their proponents believe it has on society. But the one thing I can say is societies that have very high levels of violence, you know, are more likely to use capital punishment. And societies that are relatively nonviolent, like Vermont and New Hampshire, tend to use it very sparingly, if at all. During the period that I talked about in the North in the 1820s and the 1830s, Vermont and New Hampshire virtually stopped executing people. They didn't outlaw it. They had some heinous crimes, but the juries refused to use the death penalty in most cases, and the judges. And in those cases where it was handed down by the courts, very often the state legislature or the governor would commute it to life in prison. And why is that in societies with low homicide rates? Well, in part it's because of the way they perceive murder. There's a sense there that it's like being struck by lightning. It's a terrible tragedy, but it's just an accident. And they know that most of the murders happen because people are deeply disturbed, you know, delusional, paranoid, suffering from those kinds of problems. Or they know that the murders happen by accident. Somebody meant to really hurt somebody, but it was an unlucky blow that had killed them. So they look at this as something that, you know, it's almost like a traffic accident. It's almost like a natural disaster, like getting hit by a tornado. And the society turns out with great compassion for the victims. It's perplexed by why this happened. But there's no sense that this is something that we're constantly under threat, and that these murderers are in some ways really at war with the good people, with the honest people, with the virtuous people in society. Like it's just something that happened. And the other thing, too, is you just have in that kind of society a much stronger sense of respect for one another, which leads them to believe that anybody who could kill somehow is a little bit off. You know, if you understand what I'm saying. In other words, it's a little bit crazy. Whereas I think when we have a high homicide rate, people are frustrated and people get angry and they don't know why this is happening and they start to really take it out on people. I said that Vermont, New Hampshire had a higher homicide rate during the Civil War era and they were disturbed by it. And about 10 years after the homicide rate rose, they started executing people. Because they started to say, what is going on here that young people are robbing and murdering people, that people are just behaving in a way that we never saw before? And they just get, and here are people who were really dedicated, almost philosophically, against capital punishment. When their homicide rate rose, they started executing people.
Well, in Texas, I mean, I've had an opportunity to look at some of these cases empirically.
Yeah.
And I mean, in the first place, you take a whole category of cases where people are so drunk or so stoned that they're not aware of what they're doing, and they do this horrible thing when in a severely incapacitated mental state. And then they wake up the next morning, they're in worlds of trouble, and it depends upon the luck of the draw of who's the prosecutor or where it happens, and can the county actually economically afford a capital case.
Oh,
so we have decisions based on economics of the taxpayers in a given jurisdiction.
That prosecutors also respect the wishes to a very high degree of the victim's family.
And we've had a very high rate of wrongful conviction in Texas, and I've got a theory about that. Every wrongful conviction I ever heard of began when one cop turned to another and said, I've got a hunch about this case, and it just goes downhill from there.
Yeah.
But are we placing a value on human life by these processes?
Well, you know, one of the tough things, as we know, is that both opponents and proponents of the death penalty believe putting the value on human life. And that's one of the most difficult things to argue about, as you know, because, as we know, our friends and neighbors who believe in capital punishment believe that they are defending life by doing this. They believe that deeply. And they believe deeply that when you take a life, you need to atone for it. And they believe deeply that, many of them, that this deters crime, even though I think there's very little evidence that it does. So I really hesitate, because I have so many friends and neighbors who, you know, believe in the death penalty, and it's very hard to argue on that basis. So I'm very, you know, it's not so much about valuing life as it is about having respect and a sense of kinship for your neighbors. And I do think when the homicide goes up, it goes up in part because that sense of solidarity, that sense of identification and empathy and patriotism and a feeling we're all one people declined. That really declined even in Vermont, New Hampshire in the Civil War. So they're more likely to execute people, as well as they're more likely to kill people for that reason. And I think it's not, they wouldn't think of it as not valuing life. They would think of it as, you know, you really are not really one of us anymore. You're not really an American. You're not really a Vermonter. You've crossed the line. And idea gets in.
The factor of the other.
Absolutely.
Not us,
where
but
we
the
draw
other.
That line. And when we're in a situation of political conflict amongst ourselves, we tend to draw that line within our society. And when we draw that line between us and then within our society, it's violent. It's not to say if we draw that line between our society and another that we can't be violent against that other society. That's sort of what the Germans did.
Sure.
And that can be very deadly, you know, what they did in the 30s and the 40s. I think when we start to draw that line, and when our country fell apart in the Civil War, and our political parties fell apart as national parties, and we lost faith in our leaders, and we lost that sense of being one people united under God, indivisible, all kinds of behavior was possible, all kinds of anger, all kinds of labeling, all kinds of distancing were possible that weren't possible when we were really one nation united, at least in the North, before the Civil War crisis in the late 1840s, 1850s.
Well, Dr. Roth, what about your really phenomenal different events like September the 11th? The collapse of the World Trade Center.
Right.
That was so enormous. I had to go give a speech that day. And, of course, I was listening to the news on my way down there. And I got there and I gave my speech. I don't remember what I said. Nobody there remembered what I said. And then we all got in our cars and followed the news on the way home.
Yeah.
it was such an enormous phenomena.
Right.
That there was no escaping, that it had a deep impression on us. And it dealt with fatalities. It dealt with the loss of life. It dealt with a potential other. But we adjusted to that differently.
Yeah, what I said, my students, our college president asked us when we came back that quarter in the fall of 2001, to spend the first class, the hour, talking to our students about things. And, you know, they were traumatized, and we just discussed things. And my students asked me what was going to happen in the future, what my hunch was. And I said, well, you know, I don't understand foreign policy in the Middle East, and I'm not an expert on that, but, you know, I do study homicide. And what I said to them was this. I said, you know, I think the homicide rate is going to be absolutely unchanged because of this. And I said, because it may have changed our perceptions of, you know, people overseas, particularly Al-Qaeda and certain kinds of terrorist groups. But it hasn't changed the way we feel about each other. And I used this example. I said I was driving home on the freeway, and this one fellow, this is 2 weeks after 9/11, he had the plastic flags sticking out of his windows, you know, flying both of them.
Yeah.
He was doing 90 miles an hour, cutting in and out of us, had to get home, endangering everybody's life, and he didn't care. And I said to myself, that's patriotism. You know, that's a kind of, I want to get even with Al-Qaeda, I'm angry about this, but I haven't changed my attitude towards my fellow Americans. I haven't changed my level of respect for them. And I felt that, you know, I just had this gut-level feeling as I looked around me. And again, I was just trying as a human being to measure emotion. And I told my students I was guessing, but I said, you know, this is going to change the way we see other people, but it's not going to change the way we
Professor Roth, I'm going to have to interrupt our discussion.
Okay.
Because we have an announcement from the vigil outside the death chamber in Huntsville. Could you hold on just a minute, and we'll be right back with you, please. Okay, and so, Dennis, nope, no Dennis. Professor? Dennis? Nope. Okay, we lost Dennis, but the execution was completed about 25 minutes ago, and the witnesses have left. And so they've all, the family has gone to the funeral home, as described earlier before. Tonight, Ivanis Valle has been executed by the state of Texas, a 34-year-old Cuban national, from a crime in Pasadena, Texas, that occurred on June the 7th, 1999. The execution process has been completed. Can we get the professor back on? Professor, are you there? Professor? Hello?
I'm here.
Okay. I just made the announcement that the Yosvanis Valle, 34-year-old Cuban national, the execution is completed. We have executed another person tonight in Texas. Remaining is another execution of Mohammed in Virginia later this evening. But you were saying, and I'm sorry about the interruption.
Oh, it wasn't an interruption. I mean, the thing that struck me, I just wanted to say about this case, because I looked into it some. It's just, it's very sad that, you know, when you look at these two young men, the victim and in this homicide, and, you know, the Mr. Valle, the man who's lost his life tonight. It's just when you read about it, you know, and look at them, you see that they could have had very different lives.
But frequently we do these stories and it looks like it's the same person. It's the same person doing the killing and the same person getting killed.
Yeah, and I just thought about it, you know, the victim, that his last thought when he realized that they were coming to kill him and he had no chance, his first thought was to put a pillow over the head of his girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
but she couldn't see it, and he said, don't look, don't look, so she could live. And I saw the interview on Telemundo by Mr. Valle, and you could see why he was a charismatic leader. You
mm-hmm.
could see how articulate he was, what intelligence he had, and it's just, it's sad that they chose the life that they did. And I just see it as a terrible tragedy. That, you know, they could have, you know, they had qualities that could have been, you know, led to different lives.
I've been doing the prison show for almost 30 years now. And over that period of time, I've gotten to know several people on Texas death row rather well. Mm-hmm. And one of them wrote me and said, I've got them beat. And there wasn't anything going in this case. And I wrote him back and I said, what do you mean, Carl? You've got them beat. And he said, well, hepatitis C is going to kill me before they can inject me with those needles. And that was true. He did die from hepatitis C before the injections. And to him, that was a win. And it's a strange world that we create when we go through these processes.
Uh-huh. Well, that's quite true.
And when you get caught up in all this historic analysis, if you can figure out why our heads function the way they do, that creates this madness.
Well, we think we're getting better at it. Just to finish up, I guess, on 2001, I just had a sense that it didn't change the way we looked at each other. And we know that many of us, you know, really don't feel our fellow Americans are our fellow Americans. We know that, you know, there's a lot of talk in our country, I'm an American and you're not, kind of patriotism. And I didn't think that really changed a lot. And so I wasn't surprised when the homicide rate didn't change. I had thought that it might go down in New York City because I thought that I was seeing something different there, you know, a kind of a spirit in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't even really take hold there. The homicide rate was completely flat. The number of homicides the year before 9/11 in New York City, the year after, differed by one.
Mm.
622, 622, 623 incidents, I think something like that. Flat as a table. And so it's, you know, when we try to measure emotions, I mean, it's a hard thing to read. You know, we have better measures going back. For instance, one of the things I look at in the book is our homicide rate among unrelated people correlates perfectly with the number of counties in each decade that we name after national heroes. Well, we name a lot of our new counties in a decade after national heroes that we really identify with our nation strongly.
Mm-hmm.
Our homicide rate tends to be low.
Really?
That number goes down. Our homicide rate tends to be high.
How many counties have we got left to name?
We don't have any. So this is historical data, right? This is historical data. Back when I'm studying, we had plenty of counties. Study peters out around 1920, okay?
What about economics?
It's like these, I wish that we could measure these things a little more carefully so we could really test our theories, you know, to be sure, because we're just beginning on this work.
Of course, what is happening at this time of the interview is we're running out of time, and so I'm reaching for the next bit of information, morsel of analysis from you. Economics, does that have, the overall economic state, does that have a major effect?
Not at all. It just does, we've tried, and it doesn't correlate. You know, our homicide rate dropped during the Great Depression.
Uh-huh.
Delano Roosevelt brought in the New Deal. It just dropped, even though we had terrible unemployment. And our homicide rate skyrocketed in the late 60s and early 70s when we had virtually full unemployment. And
boom, boom, boom.
Economic growth.
What about the feeling of our being cheated when we don't have someone to execute for these things?
I don't know exactly what you mean by.
Well one of the things about September the 11th, 2001, is that they all died in the process, or those active members died in the process, and there was nobody left to execute. Did we as a society feel shortchanged by not being able to wreak revenge?
Boy, we'd have to interview a lot of people to know, and I don't mean to be evasive. we would, and you know, I think it's you know, it would be, it's more terrible for us to know that the people who masterminded this are out there. And I don't feel we have any sense of closure as long as, you know, Osama is out there. And really, however he's brought to justice, I think regardless of how we feel about the death penalty, we want to bring him to justice.
Look,
I think that's really where, you know, I my guess is that certainly, you know, we have every right and reason to be angry against young men who...
If I owe someone $200 in Timbuktu, they can go to the internet and find me.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reality of today's world. We're that interconnected. And finding Osama is... Not finding Osama is my mystery. Professor Roth, it's hard to say. I've enjoyed our conversation because what brings us together is the occasion of an execution in Texas. But I appreciate your contributions to this show, and thank you for giving thought material for our listeners. And pages of your book in the library, this program will live on the archive of executionwatch.org.
Well, thank you very much, Ray. I'm sorry for the occasion, but I'm really delighted to have a chance to meet you and to talk to you.
I think you're going to probably be contacted a little later by the execution process that's going to be going on in Virginia, and I may or may not be a part of that program depending upon technology and its state.
Hey.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My name is Ray Hill. You've been listening to Execution Watch here on radio station KPFT HD2 channel. As usual, our program would not be possible if it weren't for the fine work of our executive producer, Elizabeth Stein. And tonight we had a breeze by Marlo Blue, who came in to make sure that everything was going all right. And those are our executive producing and regular producer, Otis McClay, who is actually in Virginia. Set up the whole thing, but it took KPFT chief engineer Steve to handle the work here, and Steve is laboring in the other room making sure we remain on that. Ashfar Harad helped record the beginning announcement and made his usual operations coordination effort visible. We were able to get in touch with Dave Atwood and have him on. Dennis Longmire, professor at Sam Houston State College, and our special guest tonight was Randolph Roth, Ph.D., professor of history and criminology at Ohio State. His new book, American Homicide, is a weighty volume, and you might get it up and see the expansion of his historical perspective and his ideas. Our theme music is by Victoria Panetti. My name is Ray Hill, and unfortunately, we will be back twice or three times next week as Texas continues the killing. I'm getting it. Listening to radio station KPFT Houston HD2 channel. I'm Ray Hill.